Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Finding your passion is one thing. Knowing if you can turn it into a successful business is another. Most people never take that leap, but are you someone who should? Today, we're joined by Johnny Bowden, founder of the iconic British clothing brand Bowden, known for its bold colors and playful style. We'll explore how Johnny discovered his passion, assessed his strengths, and built a brand that's now a household name, and how you too can align your own skills and passions to create something successful. Well, today on All About Business, I could not be more delighted than to welcome Johnny Bowden to our studio. Fabulous to have you here. Johnny is the founder and creative director of the eponymous Bowden. And this is a company he started in 1991 that has grown to a business that is now turning over £350 million a year and has over 2 million customers and sells in a number of countries, but most principally in the United States, Germany, and the UK. This company has become a household name, Johnny. And it's
You're very kind, James.
And I want to know how it all began. You know, what's the sort of story?
Well, it's a slightly awkward beginning, like a lot of businesses. But I started when I left Oxford. I'm very lucky to go to Oxford. And I went to work in the city because I thought it was rather glamorous. You know, the money was good. The girls were pretty. It was all sounded fantastic. But I was completely useless at it. I wasn't a very good stock picker, or I didn't really get the point, and I didn't enjoy it very much. And my firms were very kind to me, and they sent me to work in America in 1988. And when I was in America, two dramatic things happened. The first of all was that I noticed all my colleagues in my bank were buying clothes from catalogs. I'd never seen this before. And secondly, I got left some money by a lovely childless uncle, and I thought, I've got to reinvent myself because I was so bad at what I was doing. So I threw in the towel, and I didn't initially, although I had an idea of a clothing business, I wasn't bold enough to do it straight away. So I did a couple of other things that I'd always wanted to do. I was a teacher for 6 months, and then I ran a pub for 6 months. And none of those quite worked. I was far too greedy to be a successful teacher. I remember spending my paycheck in about a week, my monthly paycheck in a week. And then I didn't like running a pub because I wasn't very good at dealing with drunk people. And then I met Sophie, who is now my wife. And Sophie's very abrupt. And she pointed out to me that I'd had this incredible start in life. I said, well, I've got this idea of a clothing business. And she said, well, if you don't do it, I'm going to leave you. So that was the catalyst
for this.
Yes.
So it sounds to me, I mean, that you had a sort of 20s where you were trying different things and experiment, which is, I think, to be encouraged,
really. I quite agree. I always say to young people, if they're interested, I think it's absolutely fine to try lots of different things. In fact, very important in order to find out what you really love and what you're really good at. But I think, you know, you've got to nail it by the time you're 30. I mean, Van Gogh didn't start painting until he was 30, and I think that's quite a salutary lesson. But I was always interested in clothes. That was the drive.
Now, I heard a story about you, Johnny, that I heard many years ago that made me think highly of you, which is you were sent back to Oxford by your then employer, I think, from the city to talk to students about why they should come and join your firm and why a career in the city was a good thing. And I think halfway through your presentation, you had a change of heart.
Yes.
So is this true, this story?
Yes, it is true.
It was sort of legendary at the time. What happened? What was your change of heart?
I couldn't really speak very convincingly about the city because I thought the whole thing was a casino. And I don't know why they asked me to talk, but I effectively said, in fact, this is a waste of time, this job. I should try something else if I were you.
So you said that. And were they aghast?
They were, yes. I did that a few times. I was taken off the speaking list.
Oh, okay.
The speaker's list.
So, but you weren't dispatched entirely at that point. So you arrived at the age of 30. Sophie was being very direct and clear that you should have a go. How did it begin? What did you do? You mentioned you got some ideas from America with this catalogue thing.
I mean, I think I need to go back a little bit because when I was school, I used to love going up to the Portobello Road and buying secondhand clothes. And I was also, when I was at Eton, I used to write for the school magazine, The Chronicle. And I got we got a letter from Harper's and Queen, which was a fashion magazine, saying we're looking for some writers for our teenage edition. And I'd written an article about what boys, the sort of the various tribes of schoolboys and what they wore. And I submitted this article and they said, oh, would you like to be our male fashion editor? I thought, that's great for the teenage edition.
Right.
And so I'd always been interested in clothes. And I remember as a very young boy, at my prep school, I was always obsessed about what my parents' friends, what my mother's friends were wearing, much to my father's sort of horror. So I'd had this interest.
And where did it come from, do you think?
Well, I don't know. My father was a soldier, but he was quite creative and he drew and he played the piano. And I just think, you know, that I was kind of born with an eye. But it was something that was never encouraged. So it was very, very repressed.
Soldiers are quite good at dressing up. Yes, I mean, it's got a lot of bling sometimes.
All that stuff. I mean, funnily enough, my family were, in fact, lace makers. So there was something there. And I don't quite know exactly where it came from. The seed of an interest. And I think, you know, one of the things I always say to young people is, you know, you've got to find out what is it, what is your passion? What is it that you're really, really interested in? And sometimes it's very, very hard to work that out, but you're never going to be happy unless you do something you really love. And I've always loved clothes.
So that was a sort of decision you made.
That was a decision. And then, of course, I had to work out, well, how can I use that passion? And I felt there was, I mean, it's embarrassing to look back at what we did initially, but I thought there was a gap in the market. I was particularly interested in menswear. And I always thought that there was, in the 70s, there was this great trend for pleated trousers, baggy trousers, John Travolta, and all, you know, really pretty tragic shapes. Or they were kind of drainpipe shapes. And I always thought there was a gap for a really well-cut pair of trousers that was had a pleat but wasn't too baggy, and also had this obsession with deep cotton pockets. It was impossible to find trousers with deep cotton pockets. Also shirts that had soft interlinings, you know, everything had Marks and Spencer, all the shirts had very stiff shirts. And I thought, well, you know, give it a go. And I was very, very scared of doing it. And I thought, oh, I haven't got what it takes. And I spent quite a lot of time meeting other entrepreneurs and realizing that actually, you know, you can do it if you really work hard and you have a clear vision and you listen to what other people say. So I started with eight menswear products, and there was a market. You know, there were enough people out there who thought this is quite fun. But it took a long time to find our feet. We didn't make a profit for 10 years. In fact, we lost a lot of money. Yeah, a lot of money.
Right. So that takes some guts.
Yes.
So you've said a lot here that I want to sort of ask more about. So you talked about, you know, thinking as a young person about how to find your passion.
Yes.
And you did.
Yes.
And you continue to work in a way that you feel excited about.
Yes.
How would you suggest other people might try and surface that?
Well,
you
know, there is a book that I love and I always recommend called Start With Why, Simon Sinek. And it's the most watched TED Talk. Oh. And it's basically, you know, digging deep in and being really honest with yourself for what you really, really enjoy, speaking to your friends. And then, as I sort of accidentally did, trying lots of different things. You know, I would say to young people, you know, get holiday jobs, speak to people, make a list of all the things that you think you might be interested in, and speak to people in those professions and say, what's it really like? Talk me through your day. Would I be any good at it? And you can narrow it down. So, for example, when I set up the business, I had other ideas that I thought I thought about doing a travel business, and then I realized there wasn't much margin in that. And I thought, you know, I always think it's a good idea to be a very small cog in a big wheel, you know, be a small fish in a big pond, whatever the cliche is. The great thing about clothing is it's a big market, and you know, you can have a tiny share of it and still be quite a big business. So that was a kind of coincidence, really. So going back to your question, try lots of different things, but be really, really honest about what you really love and what you're good at. And I think self-awareness, a terrible, you know, psychotherapy cliche, but self-awareness is the key to happiness, fulfillment, and just, you know, accepting that you're not very good at certain things and better at others, and marrying that passion with your skills is, you know, that's the nirvana. And I'm a great fan of Jim Collins' Good to Great, which has his magical Venn diagram, which is on where
book Reggie's. And so that book, Johnny.
Coincidentally, it is here. I didn't bring it with me. On page 96, there is a famous Venn diagram, which I've lived by. And one circle is what you are deeply passionate about. The other circle is what drives your economic engine. And the other circle is what you can be best in the world at.
If, like me, you run a business or manage a team, you'll know how important it is to hire great people. Over the last 65 years, Reed has worked with thousands of businesses around the world, helping them to recruit and to grow. This is what inspired us to create Reed.ai, your new AI hiring agent. It's here to save you money, to save you time, and to help you get the right match. Whether you're hiring your first team member or your 50th, Reed AI is here to make it easier. Try it free for 14 days, exclusively available during our beta period. Go to Reed.ai. And get started. Reed.ai, your higher power. Say that again, just sort of.
Number one, what you are deeply passionate about.
Yeah.
Number two, what drives your economic engine. Number three, what you can be the best in the world at. Which, in shorthand, if you can find a job that you really love, that first. Second, a job that gives you the sort of money that you need to, you know, satisfy your material needs. And thirdly, what you can be really, really good at. And the hardest bit, in my view, is to work out what you really, really love, because we love lots of things. And, you know, what is the thing that combines that with what you can be really good at? And I don't make any great claims about my abilities. But broadly speaking, I really love what I do. It pays me the money that I want, and I've become quite good at it. It's taken me 30 years. But when I made the decision to set up the business, although we had hideous dramas, I never regretted it, because broadly speaking, I ticked these three boxes.
Right. That's really helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
So Good to Great was written some time ago.
Yes, and it's still very, very relevant.
Work. Yeah. It's still helpful to all of us. So thank you for highlighting that, Johnny.
Your
brand, you know, it's been described as sort of quintessentially British. You know, it's cheerful, it's bright, it's got personality.
Yeah.
I mean, meeting you and talking to you, I mean, I think a lot of it seems to reflect you, but you've also said that your family have been very influential.
Your
daughters and your wife, Sophie, in terms of sort of shaping the brand. Can you talk me a bit, because you obviously started doing men's.
Yes.
But now you've moved and it's changed and devolved.
It's changing all the time. And that was, we started with menswear, and very quickly we realize that men don't spend nearly as much money on clothes as women. Men kind of make do. I mean, this shirt I'm wearing is 3 years old. How old's your shirt?
A bit less, but probably a year old.
men make do. For women, women is a psychological need to wear new clothes. And therefore, the market is much bigger. And
psychological need?
Yes.
Really?
To reinvent themselves every day. Yes. I think women really care about what they wear in a way that men don't. Men are quite happy to wear a uniform, but women want to feel great about themselves, and, you know, what they look like is a very important part. My best metaphor is, if you go to the men's gym, what do men talk about?
Football,
holidays,
their training,
cars. Yeah, do they ever talk about clothes?
Not that I can recall.
It made me very sad, because I love menswear, but it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it was a much less profitable part of the business. So the moment we started women's wear, it was immediately successful, more successful than menswear, in monetary terms. And then you become, as a businessman, you have to listen to your customers. And I would say, you know, it's a terrible cliche, but it is, you know, it's a cliche because it's true. Listening to your customers and giving them what they want is, you know, the most important thing, and not being defensive. You know, they often tell you things you don't want to hear. So in my case, they told me they weren't willing to, they're not willing to spend lots of money on menswear. In fact, when my sister-in-law one Christmas bought her son 3 shirts from a competitor of mine, I thought, that's it.
Your sister-in-law, that's yeah. it. That must be
I thought, you know, that's it. You know, and you know, I said, what's wrong with my shirt? Oh, nothing there, it's a bit expensive. I thought, well, if I can't get you as a loyal customer, what's the point?
Right. So how long ago
And that was very,
that?
Very painful.
So when did you
So we stopped menswear 3 years ago. It was becoming self-fulfilling because women's wear was more profitable, so we were spending more marketing money on women's wear.
Yeah.
And so menswear died a death, but it was very, very sad for me. But that's quite a good example of you're listening to information that you don't really want to hear. And this happens all the time. I'm constantly being proved wrong by our customers. They're very, very fickle in the nicest possible way. You know,
so what surprised you recently, sort of last season or two?
In the last... Good question. I was in a trade meeting yesterday and I was quite, I had to be careful, I don't want to give too much information away to our competitors, but I was quite surprised at some, how well a couple of quite boring dresses were doing. In my own range, yeah.
Right.
And I look at the top 10 and, you know, I look at the top 10 every week. And it was quite a marked change from the top 10 a month ago. I mean, you know, fashion's changed. The great thing about clothes is it's a huge market. But the biggest problem, by extension, the same idea expressed in a different way, is that there's masses of competition, and our customers are absolutely riddled with choice. And if I look at our competitors 30 years ago, half of them don't exist now.
Yeah.
And there's
in our business.
Yeah. So many new brands. And that's been wonderful in so many ways, but it makes it hard in others to succeed.
So fashion changes, as
yes.
you said. I mean, that makes running a fashion business
yes.
particularly sort of
yes.
challenging in a way
yes.
to keep not just abreast of fashion, but ideally ahead of it. So your
yes.
next range.
Whilst retaining your values.
Loyal customer base and your values.
Yes. I mean,
do that?
I think it's a very, very good question, and it's extremely hard. I would say that we have quite a clear, I have quite a clear sense of what the company stands for. We have our rather pompous brand values, which
are... Well, tell us what they are. Yeah,
so they're three. Mm. I always think, you know, you should do everything in threes.
I agree.
Uplifting is number one, which means unique, different, colourful, cheerful. We have a tagline which we use in America, which is happiness you can wear. Now, people might sort of, you know, cough into their coffee when they hear it because they think it's a bit naff.
You don't use it in the UK?
We do a bit, but it's you know, I think taglines are strap lines are actually can be a bit of a burden, and actually images on their own are good enough. But that is what uplifting means. Grounded is the second one, which means versatile, relevant for lifestyle, ethically made, good quality, good value. And stylish is the third. We order it in that way because it's easy to remember. Uggs. Stylish is a pretty naff word, but it means what you think it means. You know, incredibly flattering. Women, you know, the most important thing with clothing is that when she puts an item of clothing on, she feels fantastic. The clothes flatter her. The worst thing you can say to a woman, or a woman can feel, is a bit frumpy, a bit, you know, a bit tired. I know, and I hope this doesn't sound sexist, but I can tell when I see a customer or a model in our office putting on a really flattering dress, her whole body language changes. You know, Sophie, my wife, I'm sure you, in your life, when we go out for supper, this awful thing every evening that I have to go through when she puts on an outfit and she says, actually, I don't like it very much. And she goes back and changes it. And, you know, I can tell by her body language that she feels a lot better wearing one outfit than she does another. And it has a transformative power, the right clothes.
So that's what you're seeking to do for
that's what stylish
and transformative
means.
Create these three?
Yes, I mean we've had lots of
uplifting, grounded, stylish.
We've had lots of goes at it, but lots of people challenging me, and I've been able to hold my ground. And actually, thank goodness for the last 5 years, they've stood firm. So the answer to your question is, be clear what you stand for, but also listen to your customers. So the example I gave of the rather boring, the black dress that I was quite surprised by, which doesn't really tick the uplifting box, but it's got some rather amazing details. It's still extremely flattering. And within those values, you have to be nimble, and you have to look at, what are customers buying? What do they really love? The most important customer feedback you get is, what they're buying.
So what's that tell you about sort of social changes? It sounds to me that they're going for something more cautious, more subdued.
Well, I think, interestingly,
less vibrant. Is that saying that people are a bit down at the moment?
I think that is a very good point. I made this point yesterday. The huge economic uncertainty, America, Rachel Reeves, etc. People are, I think, a little bit scared. But I also think that sometimes we've gone too far the other way, and we've dialed up the uplifting value too much, and at the expense of flattering. And customers say, I don't want to wear that bright dress when I go to work. It's a most important part of my job is going through the sales, working out why things are selling and why other things are not, and then also looking at the trends. Working out which trends are relevant, looking at the competition, looking at the catwalk, looking at what people are wearing on the streets, and I've got a fantastic team together we work this out as best we can.
So that's fascinating to listen to. When I introduced you, Johnny, I introduced you as founder and creative director, not sort of CEO or chairman.
No, I'm afraid
this
not,
is the company you started. Can you talk me through what's happened and why that is, or your preference here? Because it's interesting. I do think
that entrepreneurs are terrible managers. I think by definition, an entrepreneur is quite, wild, always looking at new ideas, quite dynamic. You're disruptive people. I mean, I don't deny I am quite disruptive. My family find me a nightmare at times because I'm not very steady. I'm a bit volatile. But that's the nature. I wouldn't have done this if I didn't have that. And that makes you, and to be a good manager, you've got to be very measured. You've got to be very patient. I'm terribly impatient. I can't even, I've got an electric toothbrush. I can't, each bit is 30 seconds. I can't stay. I'm always jumping around, brushing my teeth. It's really weird. I can't.
I have some sympathy for that.
So a manager is more steady. And so when I started the business, it was I had this fantastic chap who came in about 3 years in, called Julian Granville, to whom I owe a lot. Julian pointed out to me I was a terrible CEO. I said, right, well, you can do it.
So you were CEO at this point?
I was CEO. He was finance director. And he then said, you're absolutely useless at this. I said, hands up, you're absolutely right. I'm useless and I hate it. Would you like to do it? He said, yep. So he then made me chairman. And then about 10 years later, he said, you're a useless chairman. I said, that's fine.
So is he now chairman as
he's
well?
He's our chairman. He's fired. I've been fired twice by him, actually.
All right.
But it suited me because, going back to Jim Collins, I wasn't a good chairman or a good CEO. But I'm very lucky because I'm majority shareholder.
You own the business.
I own the majority of the business, and I've been able to create a role that really suits me, which I'm better at, which is creative director.
Right. So I suppose you've been smart, if I may suggest it, by maintaining majority control.
Yes.
So because a lot of entrepreneurs inviting sort of other investors.
And, yes.
In a situation like that, might have ended up being sort of exited from their own business.
Yes. I mean, we've had a lot of investors, and we do have, we've bought quite a lot of them out. You know, we're able to buy them out, but we had some pretty wonderful investors who have believed in me and have supported me and the team. And we had one particularly unpleasant one who tried to, you know, kick me out, and that wasn't much fun. So I always say to people, don't take outside investment unless you really have to. And if you do take it, try your friends and family first. And also, you should put, if you're not willing to put the majority of your own assets into the business, then you shouldn't be doing it.
Right. Majority of your own assets.
Yes, I mean, I had to put my much
to over my 10-year period. I guess you would have.
We nearly went bust several times, and my poor wife Sophie had to put up with me putting our family house on the line, which was quite scary for her because a lot of it was her money, and I'm eternally grateful to her for that. I, of course, was completely relaxed about it because I knew it was going to work. You know,
right.
And I would say to people, if
so
not,
you knew it was going to work.
Yeah,
that's quite a statement.
Yeah, I knew it was going to work.
Why were you
so
confident?
Because the customers were there, and it was up to me to sort out the problems. The problems were all of my making, and I had confidence in my own ability. I was learning all the time. I was a little bit scared, but you know, it was a job. If it didn't work, my wife would probably have left me. But I did have confidence. I was learning so much.
She might not have left you. I mean,
well, she had every right to.
I
think
another job. I mean,
the thing that I always say, and that I have been quite good at, although not as good as I could have been, is listening to other people, listening to my team, giving me fairly frank feedback and telling me that, you know, listening to my team and listening to our customers has been quite an important part of my, you know, the success.
There's a lovely quote I remember. The more you listen, the more the universe reveals itself.
Yes.
Which I quite like. Yes. It just reminded me.
That's very good. That's very good.
Yeah.
I mean, the other book I've loved is which everybody talks about now is The Growth Mindset, Carol Dweck, which is all about, you know, learning. Every setback is an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. So what was the toughest decision you've had to make as a founder?
I think most of the toughest decisions involve people. I mean, firing people is horrible, but it has to be done. And I would say the toughest things have been getting rid of people who are actually quite good, but just not quite good enough. I think there's a big difference between a 9 out of 10 person and a 7 out of 10 person. I'm just reading Reed Hastings, the guy who set up Netflix, who says he can justify, you know, the difference between a good person and an okay person is it's a multiple of thousands.
Thousands?
And, yes. And actually, so I've had to get rid of some really nice people. And that's been hard. I mean,
and that's been your experience too.
Yes.
The difference between a 9 person and a 7 person.
Yes, I've got a lot
of. What makes a person a 9 person? You know, for people listening,
it's a combination of ability, temperament, energy. Somebody who is really good fun to work with, who's really open, not defensive, really good, quick to learn, quick to admit mistakes. I put a lot of store in those qualities that you're not really allowed to interview and mention interviews, but you know, all that stuff about their personality, their attitude, their background, things that you're not really meant to ask about, but I do.
Well, we have a book called Put Your Mindset to Work with a co-author, Paul Stoltz.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in this. And you're describing a growth mindset.
Yeah,
you mentioned Carol Dweck, obviously.
Yeah.
Then there's another quote: character is everything.
Yes.
I think. So it's sort of it's very important. And one thing we notice in our business, we have sort of high achievers lunches, and we sort of ask everyone about their background, you know, how they started out in work.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people who there's one consistent thread: all of them did jobs as teenagers.
Yes, I completely agree. In fact, one of my key interview questions is, what holiday jobs have you done?
Yeah.
And if they can't think of one, they forget it.
Yeah, that was they all worked doing various, you know, yes, paper rounds, working on ice cream vans, yes, decorating. Yes. They all had things like, yes, that, which is interesting.
The other thing, although it slightly sounds a bit prejudiced, but I'm a huge supporter of people whose parents were self-made. In anybody whose dad's an electrician, plumber, because they know the importance of hard work.
Well, they'd have seen that, and, yes, and they'd have probably discussed business, exactly, and customers.
Exactly. And not defensive.
Difficulties.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, taking negative feedback is, you know, very hard for people. But it's, you know, I mean, I struggle with it at times, but I've got better at it. Because it makes life so much easier for the team and for you, actually.
Yeah, I was once asked to give a talk to staff at Amazon, rather weirdly, yeah, about feedback.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know why you've asked me, because, you know, as a writer of books, yeah, you can look at feedback from your, yes, readers on, yeah, Amazon very happily. And I remember making them laugh, because there was one negative comment on that book,
yeah,
Put Your Mindset to Work, where the reader said, you know, by the time I got to the end of this book, I wanted to lobotomize myself. My question to the audience is, why did this person bother reading it to the end?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I felt. But I've always thought two things about it. When feedback is harsh, I mean, if you can make fun of light of it,
yes,
that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But also in the end, it's just feedback.
Yeah.
You know, other people like the book, some people don't. You said it negatively, but it's just feedback.
Yeah.
And you might think of it negatively or positively.
I had a...
But it's very useful regardless.
I have, yeah, an annual... I'm given feedback formally every year. And I had a terrible experience this Christmas, because the coach asked six people I worked with for what they thought about me.
Oh, you have a coach for this?
Okay, yeah.
So you have a 360?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right. Okay, tell me about this.
Yeah, and so I looked at the first five pages, absolutely brilliant. I thought, oh my God, this is wonderful. You know, Johnny, he's very dynamic, and he's great fun, and he's got a good eye and tons of energy, and he's really lovely to be around, and couldn't be nicer. And I thought, oh, this is going very well. And I turned the page, and then, oh my gosh, he's very volatile. He's hard to predict. He has favorites. He catastrophizes. He can get very depressed about everything. He brings us down when he's in one of his bad moods. You know, that was, of course, you focus on the negatives. And, yeah.
So what did you do with that information?
Well, I went back to the coach. I said, I'm literally about to kill myself. And she said, no,
I'm getting very depressed.
She said, you know, you're focusing on the whole, you're doing a pretty good job. But it was, you know, it slightly ruined my Christmas, because I got it just before Christmas. But actually,
so advice for people doing this: don't do it just before Christmas.
Well, I think absolutely, but you know, you need.
You said
to
you do this every year, right?
Yeah, you need.
So
to
was it different to the year before? And your behaviour changed.
It's pretty consistent. This is a very good new coach, and she's more frank than the previous one. And it is pretty consistent. But I do check myself, you know, and that when I find myself catastrophizing, I pinch myself and say, hold on, you're catastrophizing, stop it. You know, that it's not nearly as bad as you think it is.
So would you encourage entrepreneurs to have coaches?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You've had a coach for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, any form of anybody who can help you be more self-aware is a good thing.
And how often would you meet with a coach, and what would you do?
Once a month.
Once a month?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I've had coaches in the past. I don't have one at the moment. I'm thinking maybe.
Well, I think it's also to say, you know, what are your goals for this year? You know, how's it going? You know, how are you getting on with your team? They're always going to be issues.
Yeah.
And even if you end up talking about something quite different, it's useful to have somebody who can help you look at life in a slightly different way.
So taking that information that you got before Christmas, has it moderated what you've done since? Or have you made any, or you just carry on? Because in a way, it's who you are.
They might say that I have got a bit better, but I'm not sure. I'm probably still pretty bad. But I am more aware of it. And so when they say it, I'm quicker at checking myself.
Right.
Yeah. So you can pick up in their body language when you say something, and you can feel, because as the boss, you know, it's obviously hard for people to give you that feedback directly because they're a little bit, you know, he's the boss, you know, blah, blah. But so you have to be more sensitive to pick up on their feelings, which they might be a bit scared to say directly. Yeah. And so you're more sensitive to that behavior.
People are watching your behavior all the time.
Well, I'm trying to feel something. You can tell if you're vaguely sensitive, you can tell how your messages are landing with the team. I'm quicker now to ask people, how am I doing? How did that come across? And because they trust me, I think they will tell me directly, I think you got that a bit wrong.
So who do you report to in this?
Well, that's a good question. I report to myself, but I have a pretty frank relationship with people who report to me, and I hope they can tell me stuff.
So you don't report to the CEO then?
No.
So you're free range on creative.
I'm pretty free range, but I have a fantastic, you know, the brand director, the creative director, the design director, fantastic. And we have a very, very frank relationship. And there is a joke where I met James Dyson. I had to talk to him about this because he had exactly the same observation.
Yeah. What was the joke?
Well, the James Dyson thing is that actually you've got to be able to give quick negative and positive feedback with your team on a regular basis. So, but you can only do that if you know them well and you trust them and they trust you. And therefore, all that stuff, that old-fashioned stuff about going out to dinner with them, you know, getting a bit drunk with them, chatting, talking to them about their family, earning their trust and sharing vulnerabilities. You know, sometimes I overshare, but I feel if I show vulnerability to my team, then they feel they can share vulnerability back. And as a result, if I said to my head designer, "Oh my God, that dress is completely revolting," she'll get the giggles. You know, we'll laugh at it.
No one will be too.
No,
sorry.
No. It says no. There's and they can say to me, if I say, I feel very strongly for jumpsuits, and they think that's a bad idea, they'll say, oh, that's a terrible idea.
Right. So it's important to be able to exchange honestly.
Yes, but you can't do that unless you have that sort of close relationship.
Right. So you've worked with these people, I guess, for many years. Yes. Some of them, yeah.
And even the new ones, I try and break down barriers, and you know, they love hearing, you know, awful stories about my family. They really enjoy, you know, sort of hangovers. Or when I remember one of my middle daughter got her nipple pierced, I shared it with the company.
You're now sharing it with everyone listening. Yes, okay.
Well, most young
she
girls
won't listen to it anyway, will she?
And I said it was a huge sort of, it ruined my holiday. But people loved it because it, you know, showed a sort of human side to me.
Yeah.
But I sometimes think I overdo that.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of fun for everyone because it makes the whole working environment more
Yes. But you have to be careful now about what you say, as you know.
Yeah. So I'm interested, you've really been growing your business in America.
Yes.
And yeah, that's the sort of holy grail for lots of British businesses because it's obviously an enormous market and masses of potential, but notoriously tough.
Yes.
And significantly different.
Yes.
So how have you gone about that and how's it going?
Well, dare I say it, it's going well. We noticed about 20 years ago that we had lots of American customers who'd found us, you know, organically. And we thought, well, this is worth a try because you say it's the market is five times the size. The GDP per capita is, you know, double ours. They work much harder. And they spend lots more money, that literally double what our English customers spend on clothes a year. And so we thought, well, we'll give it a go. But we didn't have any money. And I said, right, when we started to make a decent profit, which wasn't until 2003, I think, I said, let's test it. But there are two rules. Number one is I do not want to be too involved in this. I don't want it to distract from my day job. And the other rule was, we'll limit our losses to £100,000. I said, if we lose more than £100,000, we'll can it. Because, you know, that we don't want to bet the farm on this, because I've nearly gone bust twice before, and I didn't want America to drag us down. So we did it in a very, very low key way. And like one of the mistakes that people make, I mean, I touch wood because it could happen to us, is that they set up expensive offices, they go to New York, they get some swanky place. And Americans are paid a lot more than that. They hire really expensive people. So we did it on a real shoestring, and we were, you know, staying in shitty hotels. And
where did you start, though? Which part?
Because it was direct, you know, it was nationwide, but it soon became clear that we were effectively selling to the Democrat states, although careful, we now have as many Republicans as Democrats. But it was
so the coasts.
California is our biggest market,
right?
California, New York, New Jersey, all the sort of eastern seaboard, and now we're nationwide. But what we noticed is that they love Britishness, and they loved our style. You know, that there are our. Well, what we notice now is, in fact, the best-selling styles in America, also the best-selling styles in the UK. Germany is slightly different, because Germans, they don't like color as much as the American. The big difference between the markets is that Americans are more formal, and they dress up more. They go to the, you know, 60% of our customers, it was at one stage 60% of our customers went to church every week. Yeah. They go to the country club. They are more formal people. They don't do grunge.
In the old days, it would have been the other way around, probably.
Probably, yes. Yeah. And they don't kind of hate themselves in the way that, you know, there's no sort of shame about being colourful and standing out. In England, people don't want to stand out so much, but in America they love standing out, you know. It's exactly the same as the UK in the marketing, but it's been a question of really listening to what they want, and you know, it's not as different as you think it is, actually, just they have more money.
So logistically, do you have a big warehouse?
We have a
warehouse
in Pittston, which is the other rule was that we had to be able to get backs and forwards from our warehouse without too much trouble. So it's a 3-hour car drive from New York. It's in Pennsylvania, and they're the most lovely people. That's all we have. We don't have any other offer.
And everything's shipped from there.
Yes, some stuff is shipped from the UK. It's causing us a few problems, but
with tariffs.
Tariffs, yeah.
So once he put tariffs on, that are affecting.
So we you know, sadly, there is no domestic clothing industry in either the UK or the US. So everything is made in Far East, India, North Africa, Portugal, Turkey. You know, we have quite a lot, but he doesn't believe in free trade.
Putting the costs up for you.
Putting our costs up, which we're having to absorb, yes.
Right. So the tariffs will vary with those different locations. And that adds complexity as well.
The real problem with Mr. Trump is that his constant changes of mind. You know, you can deal with many, but you can't deal with uncertainty. So my poor buying team have been charging around the world trying to find new factories in response to his tariffs. Mm. And then he changed his mind again. So, you know, we put lots of production away from China to India, and now he's slapped tariffs of 50% on India.
Right.
And, you know, it's difficult to navigate.
Sounds very difficult.
But it's still a huge market. We're opening our first store in America in November. And that's
where's that going to be?
It's going to be in Atlanta,
right?
In Georgia. Retail space is much cheaper in America than in the UK, and there are if we opened a shop in the UK, half of the target market that walked past would have heard of us, whereas in the US it's only 9%. So we've got a 91% awareness deficit in the US.
Right.
So we have a higher chance of getting people into the store that aren't existing customers.
Is that why you're doing it?
Yes.
It's a different business model.
It's basically...
Do you imagine having lots of stores?
Yes, if it works, we will have more. Yes, definitely.
Right.
That's the idea. Complete. It's,
there's... Do you have stores in...
No, we had some...
You did have some in the UK.
No, didn't work. We stopped
them. I
remember
seeing one or two. Yeah.
We made every mistake in the book and closed it down a couple of years ago.
But you think it might work there, but what, because the costs are low?
The costs are low. We've learned a lot more about how to do it. We've got a better team. I think we've got the ranges a bit better. We're clear about what's going to draw people in. I have also been very involved in the design, which could be a bad thing. But in the one thing, I had a pretty big hiccup with a chief executive a couple of years ago that didn't work. And the big lesson I learned from that was you're either in or you're out. And now I'm fully in.
What do you mean, personally?
Personally. And
oh,
so,
I see.
So, anything I do...
Well, you sort of delegated a bit.
Yes,
so I
delegate an awful lot.
Right. And
people don't want to believe this, but I have very little involvement in IT, finance, merchandising, operations, logistics, but design, I have a lot of involvement. And so now, psychologically, I feel you need to be, you're all over everything or you're not at all. So I get offended by bad taste.
Mm.
And if I see anything that I think is dodgy, even if it's a button or a font in an ad or a color of a catalog cover.
So you're all over the detail.
I'm all over it. Yeah. And with the shop, what one of the things that I've learned with my coach is that you need to be strong, and one of my problems as a person is that I was quite very well, my parents were very trusting, good people, and they trusted everybody.
Mm.
And I was too trusting a person. And so when somebody sort of pushes back on me, I kind of say, oh, fine, you know what you're doing. And we had this chap, very nice guy, and he pushed back, and I lost I lost my kind of self-worth because he bullied me. And now, and this happened with
Your CEO did that.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. And this happened with our shop in London, where the designers did stuff I didn't really like, but I thought, oh, they knew better. And I rolled over. And once you roll over on the small things, you roll over for everything. That's my experience. So now I'm saying, I'm driving everybody bonkers because I'm saying, no, that the font for the opening hours on the door is wrong.
Right.
Can we want to redo that? So I'm now,
So when you say you're all in or all out, you're all in.
I'm all in.
Is it true that you said that you felt bullied? I mean, you're
yes.
the founder of a company, it's got your name
yes.
on the door, and that still happens.
But
so it shows it can happen to anyone.
It happens to anybody,
place.
Yeah. It's yeah. very, very, and particularly, I think we British, we're quite sort of, we're quite polite. We want to be liked. We don't want to make a scene. And, that's dangerous.
So how did you extricate yourself from that?
Well, he left.
Right.
It was the numbers were really bad, and it was very unfortunate. And he was a nice guy. He went happily. Well, not happily, but he went.
Yeah.
And then we
and
lost.
You came back in
2 years ago. We lost 15 million quid. We were losing 50,000 quid a day.
Wow.
So it was quite painful.
And you've corrected that.
We corrected that. Yeah.
So that illustrates your point of a 9 or a 7. Pretty
exactly.
Pretty
exactly. Exactly. And if you were
succinctly.
To meet this chap, very nice guy, very plausible. I mean,
so you hired him, I guess.
What?
You hired him.
Well, I mean, you know more about hiring than I do, but
we all make mistakes.
So we have three prongs to our recruitment. Number one is interview, a third interview, a third live tests, and a third references.
Right. Yeah. So that was...
And in this case, yeah, I don't want to go into too much detail.
No, but not every hire works out, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. And the key thing
is every level in a business.
Exactly. Yeah. But we're much better at hiring than we used to be because we follow these.
And you're giving that more attention, yes, by the sound of it.
And the live test is a particularly useful indicator, actually, of somebody's ability.
What do you test them with?
Well, it depends on the role, but I always find people are so good at, you know, people are getting better and better at interviewing. And they submit these incredible portfolios, and it's very hard to wade through this, you know, self-aggrandizing.
But for a designer, what would you test them? You just go,
So we would lock them in a room. We would say, okay, here is the brief. It's a spring season. Here is the mood board. It's informal end use. Design 10 dresses in the next hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, literally, there's a job. And
a lot of people can give you these amazing portfolios that they haven't done themselves.
Interesting.
I hired this woman from a brand you'll have heard of. She was her portfolio was amazing. She was American. She was great. She just talked the talk, completely useless because somebody else had done the portfolio for her.
So this thing, quite a lot of that is authenticized. Is that the right word? Finding out if that's the authentic person.
Yes, that's a live test.
Through the references, the live test.
Yes.
In the interview, you get to know them to an extent, but those other two.
I always think when you interview people, it's not just a question of what you think. Is, you know, get people throughout the organization to meet them. Because, you know, women are brilliant. They have a sixth sense that men don't always have.
Well, assessing people, right?
They can spot a rotter quicker than a bloke can, in my view.
Right, that's your experience.
Well, I have three daughters. Yeah. My wife is pretty good. She'll just spot something that I don't spot.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I would definitely not have a male-only interviewing board. I would definitely have 50-50 at least, male-female.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea anyway, isn't it? Yeah, but that's an interesting observation from your experience.
Yeah.
So the first shop opens in Atlanta when?
November.
Oh, very soon. Fantastic.
Yeah, we're taking a London bus out there. We've painted a London bus. We've got this company livery, which is pink and green stripes. And
we're taking
that out there where we're giving everybody lots of tea. Big discussion yesterday, what type of tea? I'm a great tea snob and I can't bear tea bags.
You like the detail, John, so you've got to get the right one. You don't like tea bags.
I can't bear tea bags. No.
So you're going to have loose.
Yeah, and this is really,
leaves.
We've got to take those.
But then you have to have all the little things to put them in, don't you?
So that's become a big logistical issue, because they don't have those in America.
No.
And
what do they call those things? Tea strainers.
But there's also that sort of ball you can put the leaves in. And anyway.
Perhaps you should sell them in the shop as well.
We are. Well, watch this space. We are doing a collaboration with a famous mug brand that we're going to sell in the shop. We're taking my. We're doing a collaboration with some books. We've got artists. We're doing quite a few things. I mean, I always think that you're setting up a business. You know this as well as I do, that you have to throw a lot of, forgive my language, shit at the wall, and you don't know what's going to work, and just see what sticks. You know, marketing, you know, no amount of theory can help. I mean, it's useful, but it's by no means, you just have to try lots of different things and just see what works.
Aggressive trial and error, I was once told it.
Well, that's exactly right.
See what sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's your strategy then?
Yes.
But you must have a plan in place. You know, if that works, you've got to roll out.
Correct, yeah. But the issue is, you know, do we spend lots of money on billboards, or do we spend lots of money on doing customer evenings in the shops?
So what have you decided to do?
We'll try everything.
You're going to do a bit of both?
A bit of everything, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I wish you every success with that.
Thank you, Joe.
So, what other future plans for both?
Well, that is a big one. I mean, one thing we did, we sell in a lot of other countries, but it's, you know, each country has its vagaries, and therefore, you know, to do well, you have to spend a lot of time working out each market's needs and oddities. And therefore, you should concentrate on the big one.
Yeah.
So we know, for example, we sell in Australia and France, but you know, the French people don't really like British fashion and they don't really like colour. So that wasn't a great success. But it's, they've still got customers there, but it's much better. I mean, America.
Well, if you can crack America.
Well, I mean, what was the thing? I mean, dare I say it, the issue with America was coping with our success. You know, we were inundated with orders and we were, you know, playing catch up.
That's your focus.
Yeah. So America's our focus. And we, you know, we will continue to concentrate on the UK and Germany as well. But US retail, we have got other things that that slightly secret of other product areas we might go into. But it's a huge market, clothing.
Mm, it is.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, looking sort of into the future a bit for the fashion industry, these new technologies, AI,
yes.
how things are sort of presented to customers, how that technology might be applied.
Yes.
Do you have any final thoughts or observations? Well, future entrepreneurs, I suppose.
We are embracing, we are trying AI, and I think, you know, the most extraordinary thing is you can now, as you know, AI can create models. They can look at your existing models that you're using, and they can then come up with some fake people to look like your models. We can do some of our photography, but it still requires, you know, the skills will be transferred to other areas. But we are already using AI with some of our analysis, numbers analysis, and of course we have to try these things. In the same way.
So do you think people will quite happily be buying dresses off AI models in the future?
Yes.
And not bat an eyelid, probably.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure they will be.
Because it's just how the dress is presented.
Yes.
That's not good news for models, is it, I suppose?
Not good news for models. But, you know, the skills will, you know, you never know. It's rather like when the internet came along, our calls, we used to have this massive call center.
Yeah,
and you know, so that job went. But those, you know, there are still.
You probably employ more people now than you did back then.
Well, exactly. You know, it's just growth and progress.
Yeah,
that's not a very good answer. But we are trying AI, and who knows? The key thing is to be nimble and to stick to what you're good at.
Are there any other thoughts you'd like to share with that would-be fashion entrepreneur, Johnny, to wrap up? Have a go, by the sound of things.
I think the final, anybody who wants to set up a business, I do think there's an awful lot you can learn by testing the idea with your friends, you know, asking them what they think, listening, you know, testing the idea to potential customers before committing. I remember one of the ideas I had before I set up the clothing business was to sell pictures and prints. I came across a company that was selling an antique reproductions of antique architectural drawings to hotel chains. I thought, this is a brilliant idea. It's effectively you're photocopying an old picture, huge markup. And I said, we could try this to a retail audience. And I created a focus group, and I showed it to 12 women who I thought might be potential customers. Not one liked it.
Right.
And, you know, I do think that a lot of people get obsessed about the wrong things when they're setting up a business. The most important thing is this a product or a service that people are willing to pay for and change their behavior? And if you haven't got that, then you haven't got a business, and everything else follows.
And you can find out a lot about that simply by asking.
Yes, absolutely.
And listening to what they have to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that's a very good place to conclude our conversation. Thank you very much, Johnny, for coming.
John, thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure and full of interesting thoughts and insights.
And not too many indiscretions, I hope.
No. Okay. Not as far as I'm concerned. It's free speech in this studio.
Oh, we love that.
We love it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you two concluding questions, which I ask everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first is, because we love Mondays at Reed, what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning?
I might burst into tears, actually. I love the people I work with. I love creating lovely things.
I can feel your strength of emotion. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with bursting into tears at all. I That came over beautifully. So thank you. And the last question is from my interview book, Why You? Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Well, this is a question that my wife asked me. And the awful thing is, I so enjoy what I do that if I'm still getting it right, I will still be here. The moment I start choosing terrible clothes and annoying people a lot, then I will stop. I think what I need to get better at is, you know, more holiday. But I say to my wife when she has a go at me, well, you know, if I'm more than 3 days with you alone in the kitchen, you want to kill me. So, in fact, you might try I was in the office anyway. Well, and I don't know whether Nicola says
I hope you remain alive and well and yes. Gainfully employed and enjoying yourself yes, in 5 years' yeah. time.
No, I mean, it's lovely. I'm so lucky to be able to do something that I enjoy and that I'm quite good at.
Oh, I agree. Thanks so much
for coming to talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Johnny. Thank you, Johnny, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Johnny, and Bowden, all links are in the show notes. See you next time.